I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is television actor and activist Ed Asner. He's joined on stage by former Mary Tyler Moore Show producer Ed Weinberger. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Ed Asner and Ed Weinberger.
Ed Asner is here this evening. A TV legend best known for his role as the gruff Lou Grant on The Mary Tyler Moore Show and subsequent spinoff Lou Grant. He is the winner of 7 acting Emmy Awards and has been nominated a total of 20 times. In addition to his acting, Mr. Asner has also spent much of the past 30 years speaking out on a wide range of progressive political issues and human rights causes, among them disability rights, HIV/AIDS, denialism, and free speech. He served 2 terms as president of the Screen Actors Guild from 1981 to 1985, during which he was an outspoken critic of former SAG president Ronald Reagan, then the U.S. president, for his Central American policy. Mr. Asner is here this evening to discuss his new book, The Grouchy Historian, his charge for liberals to reclaim the Constitution from right-wingers who want to use it as their justification for everything they want to do. Appearing in conversation with Mr. Asner this evening is Ed Weinberger, co-author of The Grouchy Historian and the multi-award-winning writer and producer of The Mary Tyler Moore Show, among many, many other hit TV shows. Let's give them both a warm welcome.
Give it up. Now you're pooped.
Okay. I'm Ed Weinberger, in case you hadn't noticed, and this is Ed Asner. So let's tell you a little bit about the book and why Mr. Asner chose to write it, and we could keep it in conversation. But to give you a flavor of it, why don't we read a portion?
This is the introduction to our book. Why I wrote this book. O ye that love mankind, ye that dare oppose not only the tyranny, but the tyrant, stand forth. Thomas Paine, Common Sense, 1776. Nobody thumps the Constitution like a right-wing Republican. Conservatives love the Constitution, invoking its very name, even more than the Bible and Ronald Reagan, as all the proof they need that God is on their side. It's not enough that they think they own the Constitution. They act as if they wrote the damn thing. The Constitution is the cornerstone of the Republican Party's agenda, along with small government, less regulation, and making sure the rich pay less taxes than the rest of us. Republicans are supported by a phalanx of right-wing radio and TV hosts who wave the Constitution at us like so many brainwashed Chinese once hefted copies of Chairman Mao's Little Red Book. Mark Levin and Glenn Beck have made small fortunes publishing books that write the Constitution to suit themselves. Rush Limbaugh's website once featured him beside a blow-up of the Constitution's preamble, a wide smile across his face as if he had just scored a prescription for painkillers. Bill O'Reilly used to give away free copies of the Constitution with every purchase of his Patriot coffee mug. That was, of course, before he was fired from his television show, where he advocated family values on the one hand, while calling female employees and masturbating with the other hand. From the party politicians to the Wall Street editorial board, all share the same distorted view. Progressives, with the aid of pinko academics and activist judges, have been on a century-long march to disfigure the Constitution, bend it to their own evil objectives, and undo the social order as ordained by our country's founding fathers. To give you some idea of what I'm talking about, here are samples of quotes from their best and brightest. I, as a constitutional conservative, as a believer in Jesus Christ, readily embrace Donald Trump's agenda. Michelle Bachmann, former Republican congressperson. If standing for liberty and standing for the Constitution make you a wacko bird, then you can count me a very proud wacko bird, Senator Ted Cruz, or as we call him back home, wacko. You can go to our founding fathers' early documents and see how they crafted a Declaration of Independence and a Constitution that allows that Judeo-Christian belief to be the foundation of our lives. Sarah Palin, who is not who she once was. It is my number one duty as a human being to earn and experiment in self-government every day by spotlighting cockroaches, my goodness, who violate their oath to the U.S. Constitution and wipe their with the U.S. Constitution. Ted Nugent, celebrity Trump supporter. And there are a hell of a lot more where that came from. Pissed off by the lies, misrepresentations, I decided it was time to strike back. It was time to reclaim the Constitution. Besides, if the righties, were wrong about everything else, like health care, climate change, and the corporate tax rate, they had to be wrong about the Constitution. First, I did my homework. We did our homework. I read the Constitution and the amendments, perused the Federalist and Madison's notes taken during the Constitutional Convention, surveyed the lives of the founders and framers, looked over the Supreme Court opinions of Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas, and even tried to digest Glenn Beck's book, The Criminal Argument, Mark Levin's The Liberty Amendments, and Dr. Ben Carson's A More Perfect Union, three of the best over-the-counter sleep aids on the market, to find out how the mind of a strict constructionist works. I also dipped into Ted Cruz's autobiography, Time for Truth, a faith-based romance novel in which the hero falls in love with himself at an early age. Here is a preview of what I came up with. The framers wrote the Constitution in order to form a strong central government, giving sweeping powers to Congress, not the states, and balanced by an equally strong executive branch. Nothing in the Constitution suggests, let alone enforces, the concepts of limited government, limited taxes, and limited regulations. The framers were not divinely inspired. They were lawyers. Do you really know one or any divinely inspired lawyers? The only lawyer ever to be divinely inspired was Saul of Tarsus. When the framers wrote, "We the people," they meant themselves. Most of the founders and framers were deists. Deism is a religion that believes in a God who really doesn't give a shit. The framers did not hate taxation. They needed taxes desperately. They had a war to pay off. A strict constructionist is someone who selects portions of the Constitution to justify already held beliefs. Under the Constitution, women had the same rights as a Chickasaw Indian. The Constitution is as good as the people who swear to protect it. Now, the rest of what I learned, you have to buy the book. I know what you're thinking. Why me, of all people? Why am I writing a book about the Constitution? Well, why not me? After all, I have played some of the smartest people ever seen on television.
Okay, thank you. Okay, all right, now we're going to do a little routine from the book. Okay, so this is chapter 4, a little short piece called Heckling the Right Wing, Their Top 10 Talking Points, and His Top 10 Comebacks. Okay, so I'm going to be the right wing, and he's going to be himself. The framers were all devout Christians.
You think everyone was a devout Christian? You probably think Jesus was a devout Christian.
The framers were opposed to taxation.
The first day in office, Washington as president, Hamilton as his secretary of the treasury, taxed carriages and whiskey, then opened a bank to put the money in.
The greatest influence on the Constitution was the Bible.
Then why doesn't the Bible or the preamble to the Bible read, "We the chosen people"?
To understand the Constitution, you have to read the Federalist Papers.
Nobody can read the Federalist Papers. Madison and Hamilton wrote the damn things, and they couldn't read the Federalist Papers.
The Constitution gives everyone the right to own a gun.
The framers didn't want everyone to have a vote, let alone a gun.
The Constitution does not grant homosexuals the right to marry.
The Constitution also does not grant the right of homosexuals to win all the Tonys. So what?
The framers were a diverse group.
The framers were as diverse a group as the Mormon Tabernacle Choir.
James Madison was the sole author of the Constitution.
The Constitution is the greatest cut and paste job since the New Testament.
You might want to think about that for a second. The framers believed in term limits.
I'm with you on that. I figure if a congressman can't steal enough money in three terms, he's too dumb to hold a job in the first place.
The only way to interpret the Constitution is to determine what the framers were thinking when they wrote it.
You can't even figure out how the framers took a piss in pants without a fly. How do you expect to figure out what they were thinking? I had teenagers. I never knew what they were thinking. And we lived in the same house. Hell, I don't even know what I'm thinking half the time.
Okay, that's our Abbott Costello. Thank you. That's our Abbott and Costello on the Constitution. Now, one of the questions from the San Francisco Chronicle was the way the framers and the founders, and I assume, let me explain the difference between the two of them. The founders were the founders, and the framers were those specific founders who worked or helped write the Constitution. So that's the distinction. But there are six major founders, framers that we deal with in the book: Washington, Madison, Hamilton, Franklin, Adams, and who did I forget?
Jefferson.
My God, I'm going to forget. Jefferson. Okay. Before we're accused of being too unpatriotic, this is what they said about each other, direct quotes.
"He means well, but sometimes and in some things is absolutely out of his senses." Benjamin Franklin on John Adams. "A curse on his virtues. They've undone his country." Thomas Jefferson on George Washington. "The life of Dr. Franklin was a scene of continual dissipation." John Adams on Benjamin Franklin. "Jefferson would soon be revealed as a voluptuary and an intriguing incendiary." Alexander Hamilton on Thomas Jefferson.
Okay, so now what I'd like you to do is you give me one of the six, and I will give you a little dish or a little dirt on them, and then we'll repair their reputations. But first, Ben Franklin. Okay, so Ben Franklin had an illegitimate son who had an illegitimate son who had another illegitimate son. Sort of a record. He brags about his womanizing and the fact that he was drawn to a low class of women all his life. He was a major land speculator. And while he was an envoy to England, he tried to negotiate the purchase of 200,000 acres in the Midwest, and the deal, unfortunately for Franklin, didn't go through. When he died, he owned all of Nova Scotia, among other properties. Another name.
Adams.
Adams, of course, signed as president the Alien and Sedition Act, and which barred Irish immigrants and jailed journalists. His wife and him as well, he as well, I guess, were major debt speculators. Abigail Adams, maybe the most, had purchased the most debt and waited for the government to reclaim it in the country. Another name.
Jefferson.
All right, Jefferson, you may or may not know, began an affair, if you can call it that, with a slave girl, one of his slaves, Sally Hemings, when she was 14 years old, when she came to Paris as a nanny to his two daughters.
Yeah. You're listening to television actor and activist Ed Asner, whose new book is The Grouchy Historian, An Old-Time Lefty Defends Our Constitution Against Right-Wing Hypocrites and Nutjobs. He's joined in conversation by co-author and former Mary Tyler Moore Show producer Ed Weinberger on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Another name. Hamilton, as Secretary of Treasury, there's a couple of things about Hamilton that are very interesting, but this is one. All right, so as Secretary of Treasury, he's at home. It's a knock on the door, a very attractive woman. His wife, Hamilton's wife, is upstairs. And she asked Hamilton if he could lend her some money. And he says, yeah, I think I could. Where do you live? And that night, he goes over to her house. And by the way, this is Hamilton describing it. I can't quote it, but you have to take my word for it. Goes to her house, and Hamilton writes in his diary or journal that apparently money wasn't the only thing she was interested in. He begins a relationship with her that lasts for a lengthy period of time until her husband, also her pimp, shows up and blackmails Hamilton, who pays off, and this scandal becomes public, and he is almost thrown out of office, but not. So that's...
It's a good time, Charlie.
That's... Okay, so that's some dish on Hamilton. Who do we have left? Do we have Washington? Okay. So Washington, we all know, is a slave owner, but an interesting kind of slave owner in this sense. At the Battle of Yorktown, where he defeats the British, he finds among the British soldiers that he's been fighting against three or four, I don't remember which, of his own runaway slaves, which he promptly imprisons and ships back to Mount Vernon. So that's in addition to his land speculation and everything else. So that's the dish on those men. And we say that to make a point, that our founding fathers were flawed, all too human, contradictory, looking to make money, in debt, married for money, all kinds of things. But yet, we want to also make another point, which we do. And now...
Yet compared to the feckless lawmakers of today, Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell come to mind, they were indeed like demigods come from Mount Olympus to walk the earth, or at least the streets of Philadelphia. Not merely politicians, they were collectively inventors, architects, scientists, linguists, and scholars who had studied Greek and Latin, who read Voltaire, John Stuart Mill, and David Hume. More interestingly, Voltaire, John Stuart Mill, and David Hume read them. They were eloquent orators and brilliant writers. They wrote books, political articles, essays, and long philosophical letters to their wives, friends, and to one another. George Washington wrote three volumes at least just during the Revolutionary War. And together, Adams, Hamilton, Jefferson, and Franklin wrote more than 18,000 letters. They were men of the Enlightenment who valued reason over dogma, tolerance over bigotry, and science over faith. And unlike the current right-wing doomsayers and fearmongers, they were all truly apostles of optimism. They were, in fact, the first real Americans.
So I'm sure the quotes that we're going to get about the book are all the negative quotes that we make about them, which we do. But I think you have to find the truth and speak it. But there's another side to them, which is that they were great minds, and probably in the history of the world, never have minds like these all shown up under the same roof. So that's one of the points that we want to make. Let me read you some of the chapter titles. God in the Constitution, Part 1. And that's interesting because there is no God in the Constitution, though the right wing would have you believe otherwise. It is something that very important to the framers, that God does not appear. God does not appear in the oath of office. By the way, you have heard that when George Washington took his first oath, it was on a Bible. Well, it was on a Masonic Bible, in which there is no divinity of Christ in a Masonic Bible. At the end of his oath of office, he said, "So help me God." But Washington was a Mason, a very high Mason, as you could imagine. And all Masons end their oath with, "So help me God." I know that for a fact because my father was a Mason. The writing of the Constitution, notes from the Constitutional Convention, as recorded by Billy, slave to James Madison, May 6th to September 17th, 1787. Let me talk about that, about Billy for a second. So Billy appears in a couple of biographies about Madison. Billy was a slave that Madison brought to Philadelphia with him. And as it turns out, that he was quite educated, and surprisingly so. He had sort of grown up with Madison and had borrowed books from the library, was very literate, educated. And we imagined then, well, what would the writing of the Constitution look like if Billy had done his own journal of the time? So it's the writing of the Constitution as seen through the eyes of a slave. And that's the fictional part. Now, this is the amazing true part of it. There was a Billy. He did go to Philadelphia. We don't know that he kept a journal. But we do know that at the end of his time in Philadelphia, these things happened. He asked for his freedom. Before I tell you what Madison did, Madison wrote to his father, this we know, and said, "I'm not bringing Billy back to Virginia because I think he's been tainted by the liberties of Philadelphia." So Madison sold Billy to another man from Cincinnati with the proviso that at the end of 7 years, he would free Billy. The end of those 7 years, I'm assuming seven, it's not clear, Billy was free. And this is how we know he was educated and very smart. He went back to work for Madison as his tobacco agent. Quite incredible. And when Billy was lost at sea working for James Madison, it was James Madison who had to notify Billy's family. Billy was now Mr. Gardner. He had acquired a last name in freedom, and tell them that Billy was dead. So that chapter is a mix of fiction and fact that came out of a biography, mostly by Lynn Cheney, of all people, a very affectionate, well-written, well-done biography of James Madison. He's quite an incredible person, obviously. One thing about the Constitution that you've heard over and over again about states' rights and how, and Madison and so forth, one of Madison's pet projects during the writing of the Constitution, and after that, when he tried to do when he wrote the Bill of Rights, was a clause that said the federal Congress, the Senate and the House of Representatives, would have a veto power over state legislation. Imagine that if we had that today, what that would do to states like North Carolina and Mississippi and Louisiana.
That's possible, of course, but then you see the corruption of Congress, and you're waylaid by the suspicion that Congress might rubber stamp what the states did.
Well, now they might. You don't know. But in any case, Madison foresaw the problem in which states had control over their people's lives and was trying to prevent that. So, okay, so now back to our chapters here. We have Charles Beard's economic interpretation of the Constitution. Charles Beard was a economics professor at Columbia in 1913, and he pulled back the curtain for the first time on the framers and tried to prove that there was an economic motive to much of what got into the Constitution, at the same time being most respectful to the framers, but at the same time indicating that they had their pocketbooks were as much a concern to them as liberties and justice.
We haven't clarified, by the way. What was the name of the company that Washington was invested in, the Potomac Company?
He had many companies.
Wasn't that one of them?
One of the companies.
And wasn't the eventual purchase of land to build Washington, D.C.?
That was somebody else. There was
a company. It was not bought from the Potomac Company?
No. Well, what Mr. Asner is pointing out, rightfully so, is that when, and this goes to the economic interpretation of the Constitution, when they agreed to move the capital of the United States from New York, which it was at the time, to the South, to the swamps of Virginia and Maryland, people immediately rushed to buy land where they were going to build Washington, D.C., and for all we know, Washington was one of them, and there were many investors, and many of the delegates, by the way, to the Constitutional Convention owned land where, just coincidentally, Washington, the city, was going to be built. Anyway, so that's an introduction to the framers from an economic point of view. Beard, because of that, became persona non grata in terms of history and politics and totally disregarded, attacked, and unfortunately ignored. And we sort of try to revive him a little bit because he makes a serious point that we have to understand that they had their own economic interests as they were writing the Constitution. They were land speculators, they were debt speculators, they were slave owners, among other things. So that's that chapter. We have a chapter of leftovers, which is trivia about the Constitution, little. For example, when Washington's inaugural address was written by James Madison at a time when James Madison was in Congress. James Madison wrote the response to the inaugural address from Congress. Washington felt the need to answer that, so he had Madison write a response to that address, and then Madison answered that address again. So that's one of the little figures of the per diem at the time was $4. Many for the delegates in certain states got $4 a day. Certain from certain states got nothing. This is during the writing of the Constitution in Philadelphia. And many of the delegates began running out of money. And some, one from Georgia, had to sell a slave to stay as long as September 17th. Then we have an open letter to Ted Cruz. We discovered in a book called Constitution for Dummies that Ted Cruz had written the introduction, fittingly, and so, Mr. Eisner, we have the response here. We have the Constitution according to Ben Carson. Ben Carson is is now head of one of our departments who has no knowledge of the Constitution and no knowledge of the department that he is now running for President Trump. We have Mark Levin, as you would say, rewriting the Constitution in a response to it. We have Immigration and Ann Coulter, a review that was never published in the New York Times Book Review.
Or as I call her, the Dragon Lady.
Well, it's quite horrifying what she writes when you finally read her. And I'm sure most of you haven't. You've seen her on television. It's far worse when you get into her books. You have no idea the racism and the hate, and quite scary in a way. And what we found in doing the research on her book, her book was called Adios America, which is about the fact that the fear of Mexicans taking over this country or foreigners taking over this country. And what we found was a book called The Passing of the Great Race, written in the 1920s, by a man named Madison Grant. And
no relation to Lou.
And the book was one of the biggest books of its time. And in fact, the author, Mr. Grant, in 1933, received a personal letter from Hitler saying, "Mr. Grant, your book has been my Bible." And the conclusion to our chapter, to Ann Coulter, is, "Miss Coulter, there is something to shoot for." So that's relevant and scary at the same time. There is the shocking truth about the Bill of Rights. This is one of the surprises, and I'll just touch on this briefly because most people, including us, never guessed this. The Bill of Rights were not included in the Constitution, as you know, and the history of them is quite interesting. A couple of days before the end of the convention, George Mason from Virginia came to Madison and said, "We need a Bill of Rights." And Madison said, "We don't need a Bill of Rights because we're not taking any away from you." And besides, everybody wants to go home. It's hot. We're tired. We've been here for 4 months. And the wrap party is already scheduled. George Washington has booked the City Tavern, and so we don't have time for a Bill of Rights. Well, the Anti-Federalists demanded a Bill of Rights primarily for one of the things, because they were worried about the standing army that was in the Constitution for the federal government, which we can talk about a little later about the Second Amendment. So the Bill of Rights then became the reason that the Anti-Federalists would not ratify the Constitution. And Washington, and I'm putting this simply, but this is kind of the way it happened. Washington and Madison, really in Washington's house, say, "We have to do something or else they're going to demand and get a second convention. If they have a second convention, the Constitution and all the powers that we put in here, the power to tax, most important, and the standing army, and a strong executive government and strong executive will be lost, and the country will be lost. We cannot have a second convention." And Washington basically tells Madison, "Do something. Write your own Bill of Rights to assuage the Anti-Federalists," which Madison does in a fashion that we describe, which is the way history describes it as well, and the way Madison describes it.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features television actor and activist Ed Asner, whose new book is The Grouchy Historian, An Old-Time Lefty Defends Our Constitution Against Right-Wing Hypocrites and Nutjobs. He's joined in conversation by co-author and former Mary Tyler Moore Show producer, Ed Weinberger. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
From 200 bills from all over the states, he whittles it down to 10, to 20, I'm sorry. Goes into Congress, comes out as 10 Bill of Rights. When they're finally passed, nobody cares. The country doesn't care. They're passed, I think, March 1st, 1792, March 2nd. Jefferson, as Secretary of State, announces the passing of the Bill of Rights along with the passage of other laws, fisheries, lighthouses, post offices, oh, and by the way, a Bill of Rights. There's no parties, there's no celebration, there's no marches. Nobody cares. The Bill of Rights then becomes absolutely irrelevant in this country until the 1960s. It's an amazing story, and it was done as a political and cynical ploy on the part of Madison and the Federalists and Washington and Hamilton to hold off the states' rights guys, George Mason and the people who hadn't signed it, and Patrick Henry. The great Patrick Henry, who was a slave owner, owned 100,000 acres in Virginia, and is not who you ever thought he was, and not at all who the right wing would like you to think he is. A reactionary then and a reactionary now, that's who the right should identify with. Patrick Henry and George Mason and those guys, not Madison, not Washington, not Jefferson, not Benjamin Franklin. They're our guys, and they have been taken from us by this fake patriotism, and the book and everyone's ambition should be to reclaim them. And we have a chapter on Antonin Scalia. The emperor has no robes. I'll talk a little bit about him because I do want to talk about the Second Amendment. Scarier than Scalia, which is Justice Clarence Thomas. When you read, none of us read, I never did, and Mr. Asner never did either. We don't read the opinions of the Supreme Court justices. And when you do, they're frightening at the ignorance of it, at the amazing ignorance of these people who are supposedly the smartest people in the room, and what they write. And Thomas, above all, Thomas actually believes in what is, it sounds good, natural law, sounds reasonable to us. I believe in natural law. Natural law means the law that God has given us, which means, I guess, that he knows what God is thinking, what God has thought and what God thinks now. It's so absurd. He actually goes back to Aquinas for his precedents. And when you read what he's saying, you say, my God, how in the world has this happened in this country? That our laws are being interpreted by justices who are medieval, who are maybe, who never mind that they're, you know, the 1%'s favorite judges since Pontius Pilate. These men are using divinely inspired passages from the Bible for their legal decisions about today's world. We have what the hell is a strict constructionist? You've all heard that term. It's still, that's the originalism, that's the text is the text. And it's written in stone, and as Scalia said, it's dead. It's preserved as in amber, and it's not a living document. It can't be interpreted. It has to be understood as it was written by those people. And the framers never said that. Washington, of all people, said we are building a foundation, talking about the Constitution, we're building a foundation for future American communities to establish an edifice upon. This is Washington. All of them said the same thing. This is not written in stone. And Scalia is an originalist. Let me give you an idea of which is a definition of an originalist. This is Scalia's definition. I go back in time. I find out what the brightest minds were saying at that time, and that's how I interpret the Constitution. Mostly the framers, but doesn't have to, the smartest. He is going back into time when the age of consent in Virginia was 10 years old. This is the time he wants to go back to. And it's as absurd a notion and as expected a note. We listen to it. We hear the word originalist, and we bow down, and now it's being taught in law schools. So, and now we finish with the Second Amendment. Would you like to hear our version of the Second Amendment, or? Okay. All right. This is, I think, timely. Pardon me for, I need an assistant. It's like a magic act here. I need, there she is. Okay. Here's, now, I thought it'd be a smaller crowd. So, can you read this? Can you read it? I'll read it. No. All right, I'll read it to you. All right. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed. That's the Second Amendment. That's what everybody has trouble with. Even though President Obama didn't quite understand. Now, let me point out that the NRA's motto is the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. They take, that's their motto. But the subject of the clause is a well-regulated militia. The framers never talked about guns except in terms of a well-regulated militia. Not in the Federalists, not at the Constitutional Convention, never. There is no word ever spoken about the individual right to own a gun. The Articles of Confederation, which precedes the Second Amendment, talks only about a well-regulated militia. The term bear arms is a military term. It's not an individual term. James Madison, who wrote this, his first act as a young representative in Virginia, House of Burgess, his first law is called the Preservation of Deer, which states, you cannot carry a loaded gun off your own property. James Madison, who wrote this. Now, let me go to James Madison's first draft. Let me read. This is what he actually wrote before it went to Congress and then to the Senate. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, a well-armed and well-regulated militia being the best security of a free country, comma. This is what he had. But no person religiously scrupulous of bearing arms shall be compelled to render military service in person. That means Madison put in, this is before it got to the Senate, a conscientious objector clause because of the Quakers in Virginia that he represented and the Baptists who didn't want to go to war. He made it clear in one clause that he was talking only about a militia because individuals, this would not be an individual right. It's only, you're only talking a well-regulated militia. He's saying if you have a moral objection or religious objection to going into that militia, you don't have to do it. The Senate at the time thought it was too cumbersome for the Constitution. They cut it off. They didn't put it in. They also thought it was difficult to enforce, and they thought people would fake a religious faith simply to get out of service. So we know if you want to have an original intent, if you want to ask what is the originalist, there is an originalist. There is Madison's original intent It's clear. It's only about a well-regulated militia. Now, let me talk about what Scalia did in Heller. This is where, for the first time in 250 years, an individual was given a constitutional right to own a gun. A constitutional right to own a gun. This is what Scalia did. He did not go back to the framers or the founders. He did not go back to precedent. He did not go back or use common law. He invented two words, or used two words, and became a grammarian. So he called a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state the prefatory clause. This is Scalia talking, not me. He called this a prefatory clause, and therefore you didn't need it. And the operative clause, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, is the essential or operative clause and the only thing that counts. And by a 5-4 decision, the Roberts Court ruled that based upon that interpretation, an individual had a constitutional right to own a gun. Grammar. It's absolutely insane that our lives are in those people's hands. Anyway, that's my spiel on the Second Amendment. So the Heller ruling was 5-4. So it was, we can figure out it was the right wing justices and the four liberal who were out voted opposed it and did not see an individual right in the Second Amendment. And in fact, the Burger Court, and he was certainly a conservative Republican, never saw an individual right to own a gun in the Second Amendment. Nobody ever saw it until it got to the Roberts Court and those five justices. So it's always been opposed. It's been the history of this country. We've had, and I didn't make the point, which I should have, was that this country was founded on gun regulation, on the regulation of guns. There is a direct connection between, the Shays Rebellion.
Yeah.
Why don't you explain Shays Rebellion?
Shays Rebellion was a year or two
before the convention.
Before the convention. And Daniel Shays, a disgruntled veteran of the war, was leading a large bunch of fellow disappointments.
Ranged from 2,000 to 4,000 angry white men.
To the Springfield, Massachusetts Armory to take their weaponry that was in store there. Washington was quite alarmed, and as was Hamilton, and they formed a large group to stand in the way of Shays' Rebellion. Not just to put down an armed rebellion, if you want to call it that, but to put down the challenge to the central government. That was the greatest challenge of all, a potential destruction or slam or slur against the central government.
So the argument that we're making here is that this isn't a country founded on the freedom of guns. It's founded by the men who were afraid of guns in people's hands, especially angry white men's hands, who had a complaint against the government. That led to, we need a strong central government, we need a standing army, we need this and we need that, and we need taxation. And it was Shays' Rebellion, a seminal event in American history, which brought about the country. So it goes back to gun control and the Second Amendment. That's our concluding chapter, and we started with Thomas Paine for a reason, because he's ignored. He's a founder. So this is the epigraph from In Conclusion, and now we go back to Thomas Paine.
Thomas Paine, Common Sense, Philadelphia, February 14th, 1776. These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of their country. But he that stands it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Tyranny like hell is not easily conquered. Yet we have this conclusion with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. Tom Paine.
George Washington asked that Common Sense be read to the despairing troops before the Battle of Trenton, because he thought it would inspire them to victory, which it pretty much did. And I think it couldn't be more apt today, and a good way, I suppose, to end our portion. But I want to thank you all for coming on behalf of Mr. Eisner and myself. I appreciate it so much. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was television actor and activist Ed Asner, whose new book is The Grouchy Historian, An Old-Time Lefty Defends Our Constitution Against Right-Wing Hypocrites and Nutjobs. He was joined in conversation by co-author and former Mary Tyler Moore Show producer, Ed Weinberger. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espelay, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.